I have the pleasure this morning of introducing to you Dr. Harold Mayer, Professor of New Testament at our sister seminary in West County, I guess we should say, a Covenant Seminary. Now, I could introduce him by, I think, regaling you with lots of archaeological tales. There are many of those that I'm sure you have read. Archaeology is one of those fields, however, where the truth is stranger than fiction, isn't it, in general? The actual stories that one could tell are generally much better than those that the cartoonists dream up. I think what more interests us at Concordia Seminary is that this is partly tied in with our institutional, and of course, however many individuals find it possible to join us, our institutional involvement in archaeology for the first time in a good decade. Remember, our seminary was involved in excavations at a site called Taanach, near Megiddo, if you remember your geographical location. But that was some decade ago under another pharaoh, and so we're very happy to be able to join a congenial group of evangelicals to work at this site at Abira. Now, I won't say more about the location and so on. I'll let Harold take care of that. Just a few items of interest, perhaps. He received his Ph.D. at the University of Pennsylvania, the same place where the American Schools of Oriental Research has their headquarters today. He's been involved in archaeological expeditions or surveys at a whole host of sites, the names of which some you may recognize and some you may not. At Tekoa, at Radana, at the Moab Survey in Transjordan, at Heshbon, the traditional site of Heshbon, and he has already conducted a survey season and one summer of excavations at Abila, the present site where, God willing, some of us will be returning with him this summer. So with that introduction, I will turn it over to Harold Mayer. I will only suggest, I would encourage some of you, if you can, to move forward a little. I think you will be able to see the slides a little bit better that way and get your money's worth a little bit better.
Okay, good. Well, I'm very... Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here with you, and I think Dr. Hummel has dug up enough stuff about me, and maybe you ought to forget a good deal of it, but we have some good fellowship, and we're looking forward to this summer. He has suggested, Dr. Hummel suggested that I mention some two or three things that I'll do at the very beginning. One has to do with the Near East Archaeological Society. It is an evangelical organization that puts out this bulletin I think you have in your library, the Near East Archaeological Society bulletin, and it carries the preliminary report of the 1982 season of the Avila, the Decapolis Excavation and Extended Survey. Also, the survey of 1980 was carried in that. So, if you would be interested in getting into and becoming a member of the Near East Archaeological Society, there are some folders and application blanks at the appropriate tables near the center of this room. This is an evangelical organization, and we encourage you to get involved. We also have back there on the tables some literature, if you're interested. There are numbers of these, I think about enough for everybody to take one, that tells about the student volunteer program in connection with this next summer's excavation and survey. And for those who are very, very much attuned to this and are going to join us or want to, here are application blanks and a section called the Agreement of Conditions, and I encourage you to look these over and take them as you so desire. Dr. Hummel has also mentioned to me the possibility that we might say something about the general, should we say, situation today over in that part of the world and the political arena. We are in Jordan. We're not in Israel. We're not in Lebanon, where all the action's going on right now. We are in Jordan, which has a very stable government, very stable economy. The money is a very stable money, monetary system. And we've had no trouble at all in that country. And if anybody is wondering about what the situation is like, you do not need to be concerned about that. As a matter of fact, let me tell you this. We have a mission hospital that is run by our church about 35 miles away from Avila of the Decapolis, and they live there all the time. It's a hospital for people with lung problems, tuberculosis, and other things. So friends of mine are there, and I go there quite frequently, and they live there. So there's nothing to be afraid about. As a matter of fact, if we want to fear, we better start fearing what's going on in this hemisphere, down at Cuba and other places. We've got these problems right on our back door. The world's in a problem, so we can't escape the world. God has put us in it, and he has a purpose for us, and there is a purpose for us in excavating at Avila. Now, before we turn to the slides and ask for the lights to go off, there's a little ring. Can you hear that ring in the system some way? I hope it's not disturbing you. The New Testament mentions the Decapolis, an American expedition to Avila. We could add of the Decapolis. Now, there are three places in the Gospels, Matthew 4:25, where it says, large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed Jesus. And then in Mark 5:20, we read, so the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done with him, or for him. Then the final passage, Mark 7:31, then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis, Mark 7:31. Now, I think that you probably received a folder or something with some lead questions in it that you might ask yourselves and before you came to this meeting. Did that particular flyer get out or advertising leaflet? I sent it in. I don't know. But there were several questions. You may have some questions about, for instance, we might have the lights, please. What the Decapolis actually is, maybe. The Decapolis, the word Decapolis obviously means the 10 cities, strictly speaking. And if you'll notice here, there's a whole region, as you'll observe here, that is marked off in green as the Decapolis, and Damascus up here is also to be included in that. This region here is basically to the east of the Jordan River, east of the West Bank, modern Israel and all, is in what's called Transjordan. And you'll notice that most of these cities are on the east of the Jordan. There is one that's not, Sephopolis. We can look at some of them. Here is Avila up here. Can you see Avila right here? There's another one called Hippus. It's up in here. There's another one called Gadara here, or it's called Uncas today. You've heard of the Gadarene demoniac. And there's one called Capitolius, another one Jerash, another one Philadelphia, Damascus up here is included. And in ancient writings, and I won't spend time going through those ancient writings, we have evidence of the fact that there were included not only these 10 cities, but a number of other cities as well. So the term came to be something of a technical term, because there could be as many as 18 or 19 of these cities, and I won't bore you with going through the list of all of the cities that are involved. But you can see the region, and you can see, as you think about it, in relationship to the New Testament, how accessible then was for the ministry of Jesus, as we observe here. We can see that the Decapolis there is not far from Galilee, where Jesus lived and did much of his work. And it's not far from Jerusalem in a sense of the word. Jerusalem is to the left of the top of the Dead Sea. You can see it's very accessible, and when you read about these areas, including Jerusalem and the like, and the Decapolis going to follow Jesus, you can see the influence. You might say, what relationship does the Decapolis have, and what influence might it have? Well, for one thing, you see, there is this interconnection between Jesus and his ministry, and even the people whom he has healed, such as the man who was healed of demon possession, who went back into the Decapolis to tell people what Jesus had done for him. So there are good reasons for us to think about the Decapolis and its connections with the Bible and the New Testament in particular. Now, I might also talk about the fact that having to do with the matter of this whole region being called part of the Bible land. I asked that particular question. The region to the east of the Jordan River is a part of the Bible lands, I believe we can say, because, for instance, 2.5 tribes, remember, lived in that part and served the Lord in that area. You can see the place where it's called Moab down there, just to the north of the word Moab, in that area where one of the tribes lived, and then up near where it says Perea, and the lower part of that Decapolis, another one of the tribes lived, and then the tribe of Manasseh was up there, the upper part of that green area, and that's about where we are. So that includes, in the northern part, Gilead and Bashan. Bashan, of course, is a place where there are a good many crops to be raised and have been raised in ancient times. Now, this is a more localized map of the region. And I want you to think with me about the significance of an archaeological site, what bearing it might have on giving us background for the Bible, things the Bible doesn't talk about because they're not germane to the story that's being told. Remember, the Bible is a religious history book, isn't it? It is telling of God's way of salvation, man's sin. As we were singing in chapel this morning, God's grace and salvation. That's what the Bible's all about, and there are things that sometimes are just not mentioned because they're not germane to the story. They don't need to be spoken about. There are a lot of things the Bible could speak about. Remember, John says the books wouldn't hold all the things that have to do with the life of Jesus. The world wouldn't hold, and the books wouldn't hold because there are just so many of the details that we could go into. But in this area, you will notice on this map, we have starting at the bottom of the map, going up a little ways, a third of the way. Here we are. Where you see Ain Qelba, this is the spring of our site. That Ain means spring, and this is spring Qelba. Qelba is the modern name of the area, and this is the Wadi Qelba that goes right up the side there on the right next to the Ain Qelba. And then you'll see up a little bit farther, you'll see the word Kirbet Alamed. That means the ruins of the mother of the columns as we go north. And that is in the area of the site itself. And then over to the left, up in the upper corner, you'll see the name Harta. That's where we stayed in 1982 and where we're scheduled to stay next summer using a secondary girls' school. The school is out, and we can use the facilities there, and you'll see some of that in a few minutes. So this is the general area. Now, there are certain questions we ought to ask about an archaeological site, and we can ask whether this one fits some of these things, just as some of these things would fit sites that are mentioned elsewhere specifically, although the Bible doesn't mention Abila specifically nor any of the Decapolis cities specifically except Gadara or Jairus, Gerasa in particular. But there are certain things that are necessary for a site. For instance, it's geographical connections and setting and how this relates to the region in general. The geological and floral features and whether they will be conducive to a civilization being there. It's agricultural connections and potential. It's economic and commercial aspects and whether it has those kinds of advantages. The matter of military aspects are important. Does the site lend itself to being protected easily? These are the kinds of things that are questions that are raised. Can we gather anything regarding the religious implications of the people who live there? There are things that an archaeological site can give us that maybe sometimes are not mentioned in the scriptures. And then we can ask the question about the social status and structure of the society. You know, we hear now today in our country about the poor. How many poor are there? How many are going hungry? These kinds of things. Then we have the rich. In other words, we have levels of society that we don't always hear about, but sometimes we do. And there are certain things that an archaeological site can help us possibly to understand. In addition to the things that are mentioned in the Bible, amplifying these things, corroborating the matters that are mentioned in the Scripture. Now, I've mentioned that the Decapolis is referred to in ancient writings. We've talked about a little bit about Abila. Abila is also mentioned in ancient writings, and I won't take time to work on that. But now let's look at the site itself. This is the site of Abila. This light is not working always. I'm sorry. I don't know what's wrong with it. There it is. And you can see that the site is composed of a tail over here and a sort of a saddle, we call it a saddle, with a lot of ruins in here, a theater caveat, and a site to the south over here. And off along the edge is this big grove of trees that's fed by the waters from that Ain Quelba, that spring of Quelba. Now let's start asking some questions. Is there water? Is water important? In the geological structure and so forth, that water could be accumulated and filtered down, a geologist could tell us the details of this. Is water important for a site? It certainly is. Is there agricultural potential here? Well, you can see some of it right now. Well, what is it? Well, you see an olive grove right on the top of the part of the tail. And there are grain fields off to the left. I don't know whether you can see anything of that or not, but there are grain fields right in front of the olive grove and off to the left of the olive grove. And there are these trees down here. Some of them are fig trees. So there are a number of things. We can ask ourselves the question, is there military protection? Well, look at one of the steep hills in connection with the site and the northern tail, which is Tel Abila. Now we're looking at the south tail. By the way, you can see that there are some things that grow there. In 1880, they had a lot of rain. And look at the weeds we had. I have 3-foot-high weeds we were climbing through, doing a surface shirting, about tore our legs up and all. But they were all over the place, as you can see here. Notice that there's tobacco being raised on here right in the foreground. You get that as a sort of an extra. And there's the site of the Tel Abila in the middle ground, as you can see, with the saddle and then the south tail, Kirvet Umlamed, on the south, the mother of the columns. as we go on, then we will notice the steep wadis, the hills. Would this be relatively well protected then under military siege? Yes, you could have some protection, you see, which would be important. Agricultural advantages and so forth, water, these things that are absolutely necessary. This is the Wadi Quelba that goes up to the Yarmouk Valley that empties into the Jordan River just below the Sea of Galilee. We're just east of the Jordan River, maybe 20, 25 kilometers. Now, there are other things that come up in an archaeological site, such as evidence from the tombs, and you can gather that these people were acquainted with some artistic advantages, were they not? They also seem to know something about dolphins, don't they, as you can gather. Somebody did who had had this painted. Now, again, we look at the site, and we can see it in somewhat of its perspective as we begin to think about the 1980 survey, and I want to go through some of the two seasons we've had already, and then the prospects for the third one. Up on top of the Kirvet Umlamed, the south tail, there are these columns lying in the, and you can see here they were lying in the weeds, large columns. You can get an idea of the size by that camera case that's there. And these are part of what has been thought as being a temple. You can see the Corinthian part of the Corinthian column and the meter stick that's there to give you a measurement. Lying up on top of the ground, and my architect, Michael Fuller, has laid them out like this, as you can see in drawings, so that you can see that they do show a pattern of east-west orientation, as you can see, and there was one red marble column, as you notice there, a large limestone column, and what this was, an ancient temple, that's what an ancient traveler, not ancient really, 100 years ago, a German traveler came through here, his name was Schumacher, spent a few days, and he drew some things, and he calls this a temple. And whether it was also used as a church later, a basilica in that sense, we don't know. Now, in connection with that south tail, not far from the temple ruins, is the theater. And you can see the caveat here. It's been badly damaged. When Schumacher was there, he said he saw the evidence of a few seats. But it would be a very interesting procedure and lesson for us to go to all the places in the nearby towns and see how much of our stuff is over there in somebody's backyard or front yard or built into their buildings. We were over at the mayor's house in Harda one day, invited a whole crew, my whole crew, over for dinner. Believe it or not, here we were strangers in town. He puts up this beautiful mansef, the fancy Arab dinner for us in Ramadan, which is the feast time. He wasn't eating because it was still daylight and so forth, but he had all this big spread. Well, in his front yard, we could see like a column, a capital of a column. He'd undoubtedly take it off the site, you see, nearby, and hauled off to his place because it's sort of free territory, even though the government can set it aside. Well, you can see now the theater here, and you can see how big it is by looking at the person up on top, you see. Now, that's just inviting excavation, is it not, to tell us something about, shall we say, the cultural, social structure of the time. As you may well know, and in your reading of Josephus and all, it was part of the milieu of a situation to have a theater. You know, it's just a part of it. It's just like having Kiel Auditorium downtown and so forth, the convention center. You just have to have one. Whatever that means, we'd have to see. Here the architect has drawn this, and of course we did some of this kind of work. In 1980, we did some locating of some of the various structures that were observable. One of the things that we have on the site is this vault down there in the saddle. It's not very visible in connection with the ruins in general, but you see this vault. We're not sure exactly what all the vault means. You can see it has been used for an animal pen and sort of plastered over. But now look at this set. Does this look something similar? These have been suggested from Munkais or Gadara, about 18 kilometers to the west, down not too far from the Jordan River and the south end of the Sea of Galilee, as maybe storerooms. Well, we don't know what we've got here. Maybe ours is part of a bathhouse or whatever. But anyway, we begin to see some similarities between what we have at Avila and what they have down there. On the west side of the site, up the saddle, is this sort of a gate area. As you can see here, they're even using it today, hundreds and hundreds of years later, as a path to take their donkeys through. And this has got a sort of a vaulted effect. If you'll notice, it has a sort of a curve. Oh, my light's not giving me full operation here, but you can see sort of this. Can you see it? A sort of a vault effect here. And we're not sure what this is, a bridge or a vault. And looking at the other side, where that up at the top there is where you come across the donkey path, see up at the top of the hill there, and you see the grove of trees we're looking on from the west to the east. In the site. Part of what we observed in 1980 also in our survey was the nature of the northern tell, Tel Avila. And you will notice along the rim there, I think you can see it quite readily, that line of rock, that line of wall that's there, right along the edge to the right here. Can you see it? Which we think may well be the Acropolis wall, you see, of that tell. And it would be further protection. And we're wondering if there is not a major gateway or entranceway or something up in this area. Can you see the ruins going up and down the tell? There are all kinds of ruins on top of this, including a big public building on the very top of this thing. We called it a public building up here. In 1980, and we're changing our name for it now. We didn't know for sure what it was. This was part of our surveying of observing the architectural features. We have this is not too discernible, but there is a sort of a half moon structure here on Tel Avila that we think could be a music hall type structure like this one at Gadara down at Pella down toward the Jordan Valley. Another one of the Decapolis cities. This is Pella of the Decapolis. Notice the kind of architectural features that we have. Here's a very lovely cut piece and a column base. And you will observe that there is a good deal of ledging, limestone ledges and caves that we noted there were good many tombs. And some of these are used for tombs, as you can see here along the edge there. This was of concern for us, of course. You can again see the limestone ledges as we look down across on the side of the wadi. And part of what we get then when we look at those things are these lovely ceiling paintings with the medallions and the flowers and the dolphins and so forth. We'll say something about that more in more particular a little bit later. What we did in 1980, we did a survey up and down, north and south, in the site, as you can see by this diagram of 1980. And as you look to the right, you will see we're on the east side of the site, and we had these transects 20 meters on a side, and we ran these 100 meters apart across the site to get a proper representation of materials, and then we collected pottery. We not only observed what features and architectural remains were there, but we did this systematic survey, 1 man-hour of work in each of these cells, or squares, if you want to call it that. So we had a systematized, regulated way of collecting material, and you don't get a disproportionate amount of material from one place in relationship to another place. And then we did a cross-section there, as you can see, east-west transect, in order to connect one to the other and see what we might come up with material in between at one stage. Now, obviously, we couldn't do that. We had a team of about seven of us, and in 4 weeks, we covered this amount of material, and we collected on the top of the ground over 33,000 sherds, pottery sherds, on the top, and we did less than 20% of the site. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that means that on the site, there are or were 150,000 sherds that had worked their way up to the top or whatever, because there are all kinds of periods represented by this. You see, the Abila of Decapolis is not just from the time of the New Testament or from the Hellenistic down through the Byzantine, Umayyad, and other Islamic periods. The site goes back into the Old Testament as early as the early Bronze period, 3000 BC, or earlier in some evidence of Neolithic, which goes back to 4500, 5000 BC, and the Chalcolithic would be in between, of course. Now, that doesn't mean that all of these periods are represented equally from the shirt collection, but you can tell at least something about the spread, something about the length of history. Somebody was there doing something, or you don't find them making pottery. Now, you may say, what does pottery have to do with the whole thing anyway? Well, I want you to think for a minute about grandmother's big platter, or don't you have one at home? A friend of ours, an elder in the church, one time gave us a great big platter that had turned up edges with scallops all around. It's a period piece. They don't make them that way anymore. You know, it's over 100 years old. You can tell it. A person who's an expert in that kind of material could tell you date the thing, because that's what they made at that time. Now, if you find these kinds of things in sequence, and you find them enough in various places in the same kind of sequence, you begin to draw up a chronological scheme. Now, you may not be exactly accurate, but you try to be as accurate as you can to determine the chronological sequences based upon the pottery materials as they're in the various strata of the tell. But in a survey, some of this material has come to the top and you find a mixture all around. But the evidence, something's going on. How do those things get there, you see? And so we gather something about, from the survey in 1980, about the breadth of the civilization covered on the site. Now, with all the things that I've mentioned, the military advantages, the water, the agriculture, It has close connection with the other capital cities. It's a natural. Now, you see what I mean? For people to be there, because it's got advantages for living there. And so you have them, even if they have been destroyed by enemies, they'll come back. Now, here we are in the survey, and the transit's being set up. We have a transit in the country, and we can use, and here's our measuring tape, and they're laying this out, and here's somebody working hard on collecting pottery, see, in the squares as they're laid out. And here's our small crew in 1980. We did this work in 4 weeks. We worked hard. And here we are with some friends in Harta, and also the representative from the government, the man on your right there, is Sultan Shereda. He's a Jordanian and very, very fine, highly intelligent, highly motivated individual. Now, one of the things that the architect drew was this, can you gather what this is? Anybody, you know anything about architecture? This drawing, this is one of the things that we found on the site, and that's a basilica, as you can see there, which means it's a type of structure that comes out of the Roman picture with columns that are assumed to be in it, and the thing had an apse on the right-hand side, to your right. You'll notice that sort of half circle. That's like in your chapel over here, the place where the preacher preaches from and any other things occur in that sacred area. That's the basilica. Now we go back to the site again, and this is a little dark, but you can see Nain Qelba and Kirbat al-Malamed. And I want to take you now to the 82 excavation. Notice here in Schumacher's map, he has it laid out quite nicely. And generally speaking, although it's a little distorted in a way, it's not quite the scale as we have been measuring things. But here's Tel Abiel. Now, by the way, 100 years ago, it was known as Tel Abiel. He evidently got this from the natives, you see, the nationals. And they called it that. The tradition of the name had carried on. And then you have the ruins in here, and the theater, and the basilica, and the temple, and this he called Temple Umalamad, Tel Umalamad down here, the mound of Umalamad. You can see the paved road going from the east over toward the west, and it gives you an idea of the site. The site is at least seemingly a half a mile long. It's a big place, as you can gather. Here again, you can see this picture that shows the Decapolis to remind you of just where we are. And in 1982, this is the kind of work we did. We did excavating here in this spot here. As you can see, this was the area that we did the survey in. We also did extended survey, as indicated by these arms. And then we did also... As you can see, off to the right of the rectangular area, you can see the tomb fields, H and J. Now, the extended survey, beyond the excavation we did, as we're going to look at, the extended survey was to give us some information as to how closely the surrounding area connects with the site itself, or whether it's different, or whether it ties in, is contiguous with, you see, and there's continuity or discontinuity with the site itself. So this is what we were about, and these were the kinds of things we did. Now, this is a good picture, as you can see, when it's nice and green, and you can see the tail on the right is Tel Abiela, the saddle, and the theater caviar, and a bit of Kirbat al-Malamed, the south tail on the left. And this is the other side, the northern side of Tel Abiela, the northern tail, and notice how steep the slopes are. Those are steep, believe me. If you start shirting them, you'll find out going down the side in those transects. And it's a big one, isn't it? You can see. Here's where we were doing the excavating in the area A up on top of the, can you see where it looks scarred up there? Here we are working on the top of it. This is taking the telephoto, and it gives that building as though it's right on top of you, and it's not. And as we did that work, we can see the architect's drawing of what we did in the excavation. You can see the apse of another building down here and a wall series up there. Now we'll look at some of this. This is what you were looking at in the drawing. You can see we uncovered this wall structure, which is going back. Seemingly we have a mixed fill, and also we're not sure exactly of dates and all. But from Hellenistic Roman Byzantine times, basically, in here. And we cut the bulks out after a while. And up above, to the south, you can see there is a structure. And this is what the structure is in the foreground. And then in the background is a platform. But notice how that curve around is like with that basilica building you saw earlier. Do you remember seeing that? Now look here at the other one. Look at that. And look at how well cut these stones are. This is a beautiful, beautifully cut apse of a building. And the public building that we talked about earlier extends back in here, over in here, and I think this is all part of this church that's now beginning to come up. And well constructed. And we have over here what looks like another apse, another half circle. This was a three half circle front of a church in the ancient time, and it's on the right side. That is, it's on the east side of the building, and that's the way it generally is in Palestine. You have the churches oriented toward the east. Now, I haven't got the answers as to what the reason is for that. There's nothing in writing that I've ever seen, but it's an interesting phenomenon. Is it because of the resurrection? Jesus going to come, you know, again in the second coming? You can't be quite connected with that because the Mount of Olives is on the other side. But what is it that's they orient the churches toward the east? Is it because they don't want to be connected with temples that are oriented differently, the heathen temples? It's a good question, and if you have some ideas, please let me know. Notice the column sticking out of the ground there, some way or another got into that position, out of position, maybe for the church. Here you can see some of the equipment that's being used in connection with excavating in that square. And in the square, sometimes we even find jar burials, which this is. You see where the paintbrush is? That big jar is where there were bones found in it. The small jar we have in St. Louis was not, of course, that, but they buried a person in the big jar. Again, we look at the survey transects, and we begin to think about the work that we've been doing now the 1982 extended survey, and also the excavation. part of that which we've got to be thinking about is what we're going to do and how we're going to interpret these big columns that are up on top of the tell. We, of course, did in 1982, we did some survey work, and this is part of the way that you pick up the sherds and so forth and put them in these bags, which are bank bags that I've gotten from friends of mine in the country, and it saves some money. Now, notice again how steep this slopes of the wadis are, and this was looking down the wadis, and it's along these wadis that the tombs are generally to be found. And of course, we had to survey up and down some of these places, and we're now at the south end of the site, and right in front of you in the middle is the place where the water comes out and provides for all these trees. Now, how extensive the water supply is to be noted, because the farms, look at all the green here, the farmers and the commercial people are coming in here with trucks and hauling the water off for irrigation and for town use and so forth, and we had some need of water in 1982, and we bought water from our site. And yet it's also serving this grove of trees that goes clear around the east side of the site. So you see it had a fair amount of water available. But now we're going to pose another problem. In the middle distance, you will see here an entrance into the side of this hill just near the Ein Quelbe, the spring. Notice this opening here. And how many of you have been to Jerusalem? See your hands up. All right, you've been to Hezekiah's tunnel, haven't you? All right, here's the tunnel. Here we're inside looking out. Does it look sort of like Hezekiah's tunnel now? Only the trouble with this tunnel is about 2.5 kilometers long. It's about 2 miles long. And here's the architect's drawing of it. They were widening the road, and they cut the thing, as you can notice there, where the two points come out in the middle of it, so we could even crawl into these places. And the entrance is over here to the left. And the question comes is, why were they bringing water in? It must be that they had a population sizable enough that they needed more water than they had from the spring Ein Quelbe. So they were bringing some in from some other place. We think we may have another one, another source of water as well. Now, on the this is the architect's drawing of, sorry, it isn't a little darker, but up on Tel Abila, you'll notice that there is this the area A and the church, and the architect has suggested a Decumanus road, east-west road, a Roman name for an east-west road, along here. And then somewhere we must have the Cardo Maximus that goes north and south somewhere, but we don't know for sure. And he's even positive an Agarop on Tel Abela. Then the theater you see here in the Basilica, and then on the south hill, the possibility of a forum, a Roman-type forum, and the temple. Well, these we have posited from our work in 1982. Now, one of the other areas, not only the surveying, as we've seen, and also the architectural work that we were doing there, and the excavation up on the top of the tell, we did tomb excavation as well. Now, this looks like a mining operation, doesn't it? You look at all the leavings out there in front of those holes. Well, the robbers have been after the tombs. It's been projected over 1,000 tombs just for these periods, Byzantine, Roman periods, basically. And the government's trying to stop it. It's against the law, and they're stealing the pots, and I have some pots and all. I'll leave them with Dr. Hummel to tell us where we can put them for you to look at. We have a few of them up here that we have. But you'll notice we now have got to try to salvage tombs, and we've got to excavate new ones if we can find them. The government has even put heavy iron grating in front of some to protect these tombs. And here you get the idea of what we've been doing. You see where it says H1 and H2? We excavated those last summer. And you see where it says J1, J2, J3, J4, and J5. We worked in those two, and you see those other indications of tomb entrances. And this is a type of a tomb entrance. And this is what you can find in one kind of tomb connection. You notice the bones. The pastor this morning was talking about dead. Paul calls himself dead. Well, I've told people, you better know the Lord and whatnot. One of these days you're going to be like this, really dead. You're going to be laid out like this unless the Lord comes and straightens things out, comes and takes him to himself. But you can see the bones and their pots and so forth in there. Now, part of the tomb structures that we have are these that have slots back that are called loculi, cut back into the rock. There are some tombs in that kind that have side chambers, like you see these loculi, and then a side chamber, like that deep chamber up there. Here's an example of a side chamber, very beautifully decorated, you see, here with all this debris in it before it was taken out. And then there are another kind of tomb type, and that is what's called an arcosolia type, or arcosolium singular. And these have little cut places in the side with a sort of an arched area over the top, a very nice little, I suppose, maybe like a homey way of constructing, if you want to think of it that way. We have this type as well. And then we have just a bench type, a sort of a bench off on the side of the room, as you can see here, with the bones lying on the bench. So these are some of the types. And then we talk about not only this area of material coming out of the tombs, the type of tomb construction that they had, and you might ask the question, why did they bury it? Some of these tomb types may tell us something about the chronological period involved. But from a religious viewpoint, as we think of our excavation and what it might show us, we can see these idols or images. Can you see them back there? Look at them. There's what they look like. And we found numbers of these things. What are they? Does this indicate a cult of the dead? How would this relate to anybody who was a Christian living in the area? Now remember, in Transjordan, there are evidences with all these churches and places and multiple churches. There was a sizable Christian population in Transjordan at one time. Not true today, but there was at one time. Now how does something like this relate? What does this mean? If you see what I mean, does this mean there's a cult of the dead? There's some indication that it may well be. Maybe this is before the Christian influence got in, but it's something that has to be taken into consideration, you see. And you remember what the Bible says about people not worshiping images? not being influenced by false gods. We have lots of things in the Bible mentioned along this particular line. You shall have no other gods before me. And one of the things that we find in some of these tombs are the, where you see the shaded areas are in front of these loculi, are sealed ceiling stones. And then there may be plaster, maybe, and fresco painted on the outside of these. And you can see the statues, those images that are very ugly. And these are indications also often of the cult of the dead being practiced, as you can see this described. And here's another one that shows you the same. Now, another indication of religious connection is this temple facade. This is in one of the tombs. This tomb is badly marred. A beautiful tomb it was. Look at that facade of that temple on the side of the inside that tomb, you see, which would indicate some religious connections, maybe heathen connections. This would be one indication in one of the tombs. There were some crosses carved that at least at a certain period, Christians presumably were using the tombs and cut the cross into the side next to the arcosolium, as you can observe there. Now, people who would come to honor the dead, possibly, or when they were burying them, would need light in the place. And here is an indication of a lamp, a couple of lamps in the niche, you see, because you have to have light, and you can imagine trying to breathe in that kind of situation. They also had sumps, or some of them had these depressions in the middle, and the question has been raised, what these mean? See, with the loculi off to the side. One suggestion was that they dug them down because there wasn't enough headroom. Well, why didn't they dig out from the top rather than that? Or as a drainage area. But a very intriguing interpretation is that this was to represent a normal Roman-type house, which had an impluvium in the atrium with an opening in the sky, and the water would come down, and then you'd have rooms off to the side. And it may be, it's an interpretation at least, that this was to be a representation as near as possible of what a person's home was like. And he was buried in that kind of a setting, which would make sense because they bury all kinds of things with them, plates and bowls and jewelry and lamps and oil lamp containers and all kinds of things with the dead. Now, some of the things that we found three very interesting statues, figurines, cast figurines, this horse and rider, this woman, whom we think is Terpsichore, the muse, and with her leg outstretched in the dance and so forth, and with the lyre. And then the third one, sorry that it's rather exposed, but this is what we think is Dionysius, or Dionysus, the god of wine. Now, this was found in one of the loculi, in one of the tombs. Now, what does that mean? What were they doing with these things? Religiously, what does it mean? Does it mean that this was to give them pleasure in the afterlife, or what? Now, you can see here again the bones and the things in the back of the loculus. Now, sometimes well, we have evidence that they buried people seemingly in wooden coffins. Look at here. Look at the wood. Still attached to this nail. I took the picture in St. Louis. We've got these things in St. Louis here out of the seminary. And also a copper strapping and rings like this, possibly for the coffins. And this would indicate possibly some real care for the dead by the people who were concerned for them and putting them there. Now, I assure you this is a modern individual that's lying in the niche, in the loculus. But this is to represent the idea of which direction you put the dead in. In this particular tomb, find the loculi, there were six of these, in there, the dead were placed with the head in first and the feet out, but in this one, it was a reverse. There would seem to be a mixed tradition, and it may be because of the wooden coffin business, that it didn't make any difference if they had them in a wooden coffin, which end they put the person in. Now, you can see that we have some pieces of wood. Most of the wood's gone after this many hundreds of years. Now, some of the things that we find that would indicate status, society, are such things as rings like this gold ring. And an alabaster piece like this, and a lovely glass bowl, and the ceiling paintings we've looked at before would indicate some affluence. There were rich people there, paintings like this, Also, that women were involved in the burials. They just didn't bury the men and the children. There are indications of men and women and children. This woman's safety pin, like fibula, and beads, and a stone brazier, and needle. And we come to the entrance to the tomb as to how this all comes about. And here you have these blocking stones to protect the tombs as best you can. And one of the things that Dr. Davis of Grace Seminary, who is the tomb excavator, has been doing is measuring the tool marks inside these tombs. And he can tell you how many masons were involved in this, whether they were right-handed or left-handed from the stroke and so forth. You can tell the width of the blade and the like. And, of course, the interesting postulation is, was there a guild of masons that did this and that you hired them out? In some of these very elaborate tombs, some people must have had some money in order to do this, but there are other things that would indicate people who didn't have that amount of money. But now notice along again, we see the tomb area along the wadi, one of the tomb areas. Now we're going to just project for a few minutes as we conclude today the things that we want to be looking at in next season, next summer. We're going to do some more concentration and reevaluating the regional survey. We're going to expand the Area A excavation. We are going to expand in the tomb work over in the wadi. And you may wonder why we've got Area A and then jump to H, because we want some spots for other sites, other places there that are in between and separate the tomb into another set of letters. We're going to be doing some more surveying, just as we're showing here, the group working on the picking up of sherds in the survey. We're going to be extending our work in the tunnel system, beyond this tunnel, into another one that may be to the west of this. We're going to be expanding on the tell itself. We're looking out down the wadi toward the Yarmouk, and we will be extending these squares, making them, they were 4x3, we're going to extend them to 5x5, and then go on down farther in the material. We're going to extend up here to find out more of what the church apse is all about, what this platform means. You can see our tag and stuck into the mortar of the platform there. Work more on this church and try to find out what all this means. We're going to be working on the kirbit. As you can see, the Kirbit Amalama, the south tail, and you can see how steep the wadi looks here. And at the top, up next to those olive trees, we're going to put in some trial trenches. Along to the right there, where it says wall, we'll put one in going north-south, and one to the probably to the other end of this structure, and then one out farther to the west to try to get a lead on just what kind of material we have in that on that Kirbit. We're going to do extensive tomb work again, as I have already reminded you, and this is how we do some finding of tombs. We have this long steel rod. And by the way, this is a Bedouin who lived in a tent nearby and a very fine worker, one of the best we had. By the way, these fellows know all about this. You don't have to tell them. They're probably out there doing it on a weekend, we're afraid. But some of them even have their own rod. We caught a couple of them in 1981. With the evidence, with the rod, you see, and they were taking stuff, and they don't know what they're doing, and they take things out of context and all. But you see, the rod goes down into the ground, and if it's hard to get it down in that limestone. But if it hits a open space, you see, then it starts going down rather rapidly, and you know there's something down there that's open. You see, you may be in a cave or a tomb, and you're looking for the entrance. And you look in certain places along these limestone ledges. You see, you've been seeing these limestone ledges. And so Dr. Davis is letting the man do that part of the hard work. Now, we got the rod cleared down. Now he has to use the pipe wrench to get it out. And if he's satisfied that that's a place for a tomb, then he'll start digging. And you dig, and this is the way you do it. You lay it out, and you find now an entrance. Now, isn't that a drama? So you can see that somebody deliberately laid this out, you can see, and put the blocking stones in here. Why? To probably keep the thing protected somewhat, but that doesn't save it always. Now, a little of the local color around. This was a wedding that took place. This is in the town, the little town of Harta. And the buses, by the way, aren't bad, are they, this little bus? I rented one of these buses along with another vehicle that we had. And you can see that's not too bad. And here's the mayor on the left. This fellow was most delightful and most friendly. Abu Walid, his name is, the mayor of the town. By the way, he has some lovely deals of his own. You talk about agricultural stuff. He's got some stuff of his own. And this is the Yarmouth right up here. We went up toward that area, and you can see how green and nice it is down in there in the valley. You see? The fellow with the keffiyeh, that red and white, that's our representative from the government. And here's the school that we use. This is sort of like we call it a Jordan Motel. See, sort of like. See, it's not bad, you see. And here's our crew from 1982. You see, it's expanded, isn't it, considerably from the 80 group. My architect is the one in the long dish dash that's there. The man on the extreme right is from Cincinnati Bible Seminary in Cincinnati, Dr. Wilkie Winter, and Dr. Davis on the left here. And we have to have a storeroom for boxes and cartons and whatnot and equipment. And in our photography room, there are rooms enough for these kinds of things, the architect's room. And here we are getting a little aperitif, a little refreshment, as you can see there, and relaxing when necessary, and one finds time reading the Bible. And the pottery mats, you see, with the pottery laid out, the pottery sherds. Now, everything happens to be an object, and this kind of work has to be carried on. But we do get things like this lovely lamp, and bottles, and that lovely lamp in the upper register. A roof tile, it's a very good indication of something about the buildings. A bronze dipper, part of which we have all but the handle. I think we have a little piece of it, too, and those nice ancient glass pieces. Nostracon, we're not sure what all this means. I've asked Dr. Van Elden, Dustin Van Elden of Calvin about this. But we're not sure what it is, whether that's a Mele or something or other. We're not sure. M-E-A or M-E-L, we don't have the whole word. And a pot like this Byzantine pot. The gold rings, like these. Indications of commercial life, the mill, the Roman mill type. Be better for you to have this a millstone hung around your neck and you'd be thrown into the sea. Remember Jesus says, now we see visually what that means. If you had that tied around your neck and you tossed in the sea. Indication of probably heathen worship, this altar we found out in the field. It's got if you can see it, I don't know whether you can see it very well, but there's the animal carved on here, or maybe one or two animals carved, and the sides badly weathered. We pulled it in. We don't know whether it's Mithraic worship or just what's involved in it. And we come down to the end of the scene. And I think we're just about on time. Dr. Hummel, now, do you want some questions, a question period?
Yes, there's time for questions. If you have some, I direct them directly.
Anybody want to ask anything about what we're doing? You can see the richness of and the variety of things that you can gain, information you can get, that you can begin to ask questions about and say, how does this relate to the culture and the society and the direction of the history of the particular period that's involved? Whether it's the period of the Roman time or Byzantine time, the time when Jesus was there, or even Old Testament times. One subject we would like to find out about, I would, is to what this place was called in the Old Testament period. We don't know. Yes, sir. I guess not too definitively. Mike and Nethery Fuller have made a study of some of the agricultural remains. You see, we did soil flotation, and we got some seeds, millet, wheat, barley, and so forth, these kinds of things, and are trying to estimate that the population evidently was varied at various times, but that further study needs to be done on that kind of information as to population estimates. But we have to gather more material, I think, to be more definitive as to that. Yes, sir. Well, as we said, we're going to excavate on the northern tell, where we are right now. The reason we chose that, now remember, I didn't give you everything today. There's just too much. I had to be very selective and ask those questions because there are gaps, I'm sure, that I wasn't able to give you information on. But the reason we set the excavation on the top of Tell of Vila where we did is because we had from the survey a fairly broad representation of pottery remains on the surface. So we decided, the core staff decided we would go in this spot, and we happened to come right down on the apse of the church. Now, that building is of importance to me, at least, and I think it is to the other core staff people, I suppose it is to Dr. Hummel, that we continue that work and expand that work and find out what that building and the related structures around it mean. That's where we'll work now. We can't let that go. We need to expand further our survey work because we need to find out more as we can about the cultural surroundings. And then we need, on that south tell, at least through these narrow trenches, to find out what's up there. See, we got all kinds of things to do, and that's a matter of selection. The theater's there, the temple's there. If there's a forum up there, there's a place that obviously parts of columns are sticking up out of the ground. That's intriguing, but you can't do it all, so you have to be selective. But we need to find out what's on there. And so the narrow trenches, 2 meters wide, maybe 10 meters long, would carry down to some depth, and they give us an idea of the kind of material we've got in there. So we know where we're going on that. But you can't do it all. And then the tombs, we can't let those go. I think the government would want us to excavate the tombs. They're being robbed, and you can begin to see the richness of the tomb material, and you can tell a great deal from the cemetery. So these kinds of things, plus ethno-archaeology, are some of the concerns that we have. But we have to be selective, and we'll do the best we can in that regard. Yes, sir?
Have you been able to date about what time they
started? Well, these tombs are Roman Byzantine. And we have an early Roman tomb. Now, who knows? Do they know what early Roman means? No, they don't? Oh? From an archaeology course. Early Roman, 63 B.C. What happened then? On our school teachers coming out now. What happened in 63 B.C.? Pompeii. All right. Okay, the Romans took over. See, a drastic change. So 63 B.C. on into beyond the time of Jesus. And then we have tombs that are from the Roman period, later Roman period, and on into the Byzantine period. And they were used, evidently, some of them maybe over a couple of hundred years or something like that. Yes, sir? Oh, yes. Presumably, because we've got a fair amount of material, say, from the Iron II period. The Iron II means from the time of David or Solomon, maybe a little lower, something like that, 900, 950, something like that, down to about the time of the Babylonian captivity. And we've got evidence of a fair amount of material that's in the site there, but we haven't found the Iron Age cemetery yet. So that's another matter, see. We got our hands full with these right now. So you can see the potential in the place. Yes, sir? The bedrock, if you do it, when we were at Heshbon, I was area supervisor of the West Cut 1 year, and the second time we divided it up, and I had part of that, and we went to bedrock. And that puts you down there about 20, in this case, it was 20, 25 feet down. covered. That one covers. It depends, you see, on the situation. Men, you can't guess what they're doing, what they're thinking, what they're when they're living on some place, you see, or abandon it or whatever. But this went from 1200 B.C. down into the Byzantine and later earliest Byzantine and Islamic materials. So it covered quite a span of material. But it's like here in St. Louis. You see, if you did some excavating here, no telling what you'd find, depending on what men decided they wanted to do. They might move off of this place and move over there. We used to have a garbage dump out near in Creve Coeur area. Over there, you know where the Creve Coeur Lake is? Well, not too terribly far from there, there was a garbage dump, because I remember we used to take some stuff out there and dump it. You know what they did eventually with it? They covered it all over and put apartment houses up on top. Now, anybody doing any excavating down there, they dig into this thing, wonder what in the world is going on here? Bicycles, old refrigerators, you know, everything out of the sun, all piled up in here. So there's a transfer of material from in this particular case. Now, you see, sometimes you have a successive civilization digging right through some very interesting and important stuff, destroying part of it to put the foundations of their buildings in there. You never know what they're going to do. You don't know what man's going to do, whether he appreciates something or not. They wanted to tear down our railroad station. I don't know whether you were aghast at that or not. I was. You know, I mean, that's a beautiful structure to destroy that thing. But that's what some of them wanted to do. So we don't know how far down that material goes. Now, if it's along the ledges, you see, it's not, the soil's very thin. But if you're talking about places where human occupation is, then you don't know yet. You don't know until you test it. And then you try to get the bedrock at whatever you're doing. That would be the normal thing, unless it's worthless and you're finding nothing in there, and then you want to abandon it and start someplace else. Any other questions? Yes, sir, back there. One and any other, whoever. Well, yeah, yes. See, Manasseh. This is the area of Manasseh. And whether they actually inhabited it, I would be great if we found the name Manasseh in there. See, if you want to come and help us to find it, we already got an ostracon. But if we could find some tablets, we'd be in, wouldn't we, Dr. Hummel? We sure would. Like the Ebla stuff or something like that, we'd really be in the chips, as they say, if we could find it. But it could well be that Manasseh, some of them lived on the site. But we're not down that far yet. And we'll have to see what's there. Yes, sir. I have another man right back here. Uh-huh. I'll tell you. You saw those lamps? Those pots? Figurines? All that stuff? They take them off and sell them across the river in Dixie. You know what I mean by that? You know, you can sell pottery over across the river. You can't in Jordan anymore. It's against the law. They're trying to protect their antiquities. But you can buy on the market in stores and whatnot. And we don't know where our stuff's being carried. But it could be sold. See, these people are just like any other human beings. They're going to steal it and make the fast buck off of it. And sell all this stuff that it's against the law to sell. And if they get them, they could throw them in jail or fine them. I guess or both. These two men that were caught, they were taken to the local magistrate in town, and they were leaned on. I'm not sure all what happened eventually to them, but how do you keep a whole lot of villagers who know they're... And then they get the idea, this comes up once in a while, that you got gold, you're digging for gold. Well, you're not digging for gold. It happens that we got a couple gold pieces. That's all the gold we got in 1982. By the way, the government gave us one of those rings. And he gave us about, I think, 75% of the material. The Jordanian government did. They took what they wanted and they said, you can have it. Gave me permission to take it out of the country. So for research purposes, for educational purposes, not for sale, that's the point, for understanding, for trying to understand. Yes, sir? No. Fact of the matter is we had an osteologist or a physical anthropologist who were supposed to do work on our bones in 1982, and he failed me. He lives in Jordan, and he never got to it with all the other things he was doing, and he told me he would be working on our stuff. So we've got bone material there, but we're taking an osteologist with us, and he'll have to then work on what he can tell about the bones, and of course, what happens about carbon-14 will be another matter. And of course, that all is expensive operation too. I mean, it costs money to do this. Do you understand what I'm talking about? And you don't produce a product you can sell. It's really a research operation. So it may be eventually. We do have some charcoal, for instance, that we ought to, if we can afford it and whatnot, get to a particular lab. We'd have to send it to University of Pennsylvania or Libby or wherever we'd send it, and whatever it would cost to get it analyzed. But the bones are going to have to be worked on, not only the ones for next summer, but also the ones we've got stored from last time. Any other questions? Yes? Maybe there was, in Islamic times, there was I think there was an important battle nearby, the time of the Umayyads or something like that. It should be around 750 A.D. or that nature. And it can be, you see, that you have military conquest and operation that really can disrupt things and change the whole nature. So the site eventually got abandoned, and they used it for agriculture. And there are fields and places around, as you can see, the tobacco growing and weeds and all, and they got grains growing, and they got watermelon and that they raise on some of it. That care for the Muhammad part of it, watermelon and zucchini-type things and so forth and so on. So the farmers are using it for agricultural purposes. And you have these little villages that don't need this kind of, shall we say, military protection for one. You know, where you have a tail or something, and then you have three sides, and two or three sides, you can protect yourself. They don't need that now. You have the national government. So you've got little towns like that Harda that are 2 or 3 kilometers away. You see, and then they can farm the area, and they don't need these kinds of things. They can go haul their water if they have to, or have it piped in with pipes, and they don't need to get into these kinds of hell situations that they used to go into. Yes, if you want to go. Yeah, now what do you want to do with these? We have the artifacts to be seen. Look at this. Isn't this lovely? See? You saw that on the screen. See, here it is in the real. This was from one of the tombs. Yeah, it was in the tomb H2. That's another thing I didn't even talk to you about. There's a certain registration process. Some of you will want to be involved in this, and we hope you will be. Some of you may have photographic experience and expertise. Some may be interested in the excavating in the field. Somebody might want to work in the registration process. There's all kinds of and records. These things have to be, all of this has to be tabulated, or it doesn't mean anything. You just got a jumble of stuff. But we've got this all identified, you see, and we've got records of this as to where and pictures of these kinds of things. You see, but here's a sample. I just brought a few items for you to look at. Isn't that lovely, though? And can you imagine, this is the kind of size of lamp that Jesus was talking about when he says, don't hide your light under a bushel. You say, well, obviously, you better not. You've got a hard enough time seeing as it is. with oil in here and a little wick sticking out here. Sometimes you can just see the carbon on the spout. You pour the oil in here and the wick comes out here. So the lighting situation is rather meager, right?